Oh.
So it, I don't think I get a whole.
Good morning. So I'm with Puget Sound Energy, and we think we're a large utility. Our service area is mainly Puget Sound and Western Washington, about 6,000 plus square mile area. We have 1.1 million electric customers and over 750,000 natural gas customers. I am in the energy efficiency department, and I'm in a rather small group that focuses on demand response. So PSE is a winter peaking utility, meaning that we experience the highest end-use demand for electricity when the weather is coldest. So projecting peak energy demand begins with a forecast of how much power will be used at a temperature of 23 degrees Fahrenheit. We also have a sustained strong demand in summer, but it doesn't match our winter peak, so our forecast really begins with how much power will be used during a normal winter peak. So this is our 2011 projected peak. This figure illustrates the effective peak hour capacity need based on existing supply side resources. So our planning process looks at whether we have sufficient resources modeled in the IRP to meet our peak hour demand, plus a 15.7 planning margin and the required operating reserves. So if you look at this figure, you'll see at the bottom we have, wow, actually I think you can see it better than I can. I think at the bottom we have Colstrip, and then the next one up is our gas-fired units, and then the red section there is
contracts,
thank you. And the light blue unit is hydro. And the small green slice is wind. And then the top light gray portion is our mid-sea transmission that's available. And then the three lines that you see trending upward are a low, medium, and high December peak load, plus the 15.7% planning margin, plus the required operating reserves. So this, again, was for 2011. We're currently working on the 2013, or the next IRP. Probably look about the same, roughly. So our IRP process happens every 2 years. And we develop that through a team effort with CADMIS. It's based on, the potential is based on some national studies and our own experience. And the methodology we use for estimating costs based on experiences of other utilities, and that kind of relates back to those national studies. Our experience, we've done a couple of pilots. And competitive bids, we put out an RFP last year for a commercial program. So this is right again out of our 2011 IRP. It shows achievable demand response potential by strategy. So at the bottom of that, you can see we have commercial curtailment that supposedly started in 2012. That's the RFP that we put out last year, but that we did not proceed with due to low fuel costs. It wasn't cost competitive. So the next IRP will probably just bump that out a few years, and it'll look pretty similar to what we have here on the screen. So this is by strategy. So we would start with a commercial demand response program. We would build up to 50 megawatts over a four-year period. And then we would start adding other programs, a residential program using or controlling space heat and water heaters. And we would either do room heat or space heat and water heaters. So those are the two, the light blue and the green slices there. Are all, that's all residential if you combine the two. And then on top of that, later on, we would look at doing a commercial critical peak pricing program and a residential critical peak pricing program.
Kim, for the phone, this is Ken Quorum. I didn't really pay attention to the numbers on your first slide. The gap you were showing between the resources and the loads, does this pretty much, this was the plan to pretty much fill that gap from this, or are there some other things?
There are other things as well, yes. So, yeah, and you can see here that over about a little more than a 15-year period, we would get up to about 200 megawatts.
Which would be 5% of your current peak?
Maybe.
Okay.
So as I said, I'm on the energy efficiency side, and I deal with demand response. I'm not on the IRP side, so I don't know all the details. But if you have questions, I can get answers. Yes?
Just a second.
So Bob Maris just asked what the rate of growth is, and we're going to get the handheld mic for further questions.
The rate of growth of what?
Given that I know Puget Sound is a high-growth area, but much of the country is not growing at all, negligibly. So I thought, what is the annual rate of growth you're assuming for each of these three cases?
I don't know, but I could find out and get that answer to you.
Okay, for now.
Okay. And this is actually my final slide, so this is a pretty quick little presentation here. Our demand response evaluation involved, first, last year we submitted an RFP for a commercial demand response program. And that was based on a very successful commercial pilot that we had a few years ago, ended in like 2010. We put out an RFP, and we selected the strongest proposal, and then we put that into the stack with other resources to be evaluated by our resource acquisition group. So it was modeled along with other resources, and the criteria for selection included, but was not limited to, cost competitiveness with other resources. And that included a risk analysis. We also looked at length of contract. We found through this process that our RFP had only a 4-year contract, and most of the resources that we were comparing it to had longer contracts, like 10 years usually. So next time around, we'll take a look at lengthening that contract so that we have a better comparison. And we also looked at our pilot results. Manual versus automated, we learned in our commercial pilot that there's a strong preference for manual controls, and we would like to see more automated controls in our program. So we're hopeful that when fuel prices aren't so low, that DR will be more competitive, and we will build a commercial program that will include automated controls.
Okay. Can you explain briefly what the commercial program, what the pilot was? And I assume that also you targeted towards the larger commercial customers?
Yes. You mean the pilot, what the pilot was, or the RFP that we put out?
Oh.
Okay. So the pilot, I wasn't there for the pilot, but I do recall that there were many business offices and some schools. I think we had one industrial customer on it. We had, I think, 25 customers in that pilot. And for the RFP, you know, we would, again, those customers would be very happy to participate in a future program, so we would include them and then build on that. And so we would look for any commercial industrial customer willing to participate. Did that answer your question, or was there more to that?
Were they required to, in the, under the RFP, were they required to have a minimum that they would be able to deliver?
Yes. So the program, if we go back to the scale that shows the achievable DR potential for by strategy, we were planning to build it like 10 megawatts the first year, add a 15 megawatts the next year, and then another 10, and then another 15 until we got up to 50 in a four-year time period. Does that answer your question?
Just to, this is Brad Davids with Enernoc. Just to clarify, the pilot and the RFP were utilizing a third-party implementation firm to aggregate the loads.
That's
supply
correct.
In the Puget, right?
Yes, thank you.
Vijay, Oregon DOE. Question on your, hate to bring up the pilot again, but the preference for manual versus automated, how much of it was non-energy prices or economic conditions as a factor? How much of it was a more control or more awareness about what they're in, what they're being imposed on?
Brad, what do you think? Brad was involved with that pilot. I was not, so he could answer that question better.
So if I got your question right, it was not a price-based program. Puget dispatched the program when they had when they felt they had a need for the resource, and then customers were paid an incentive, a capacity incentive and an energy incentive for responding. So there was no, I think the critical peak pricing program that shows up later on that graph would be price-based, but this was more of a capacity-based deal, if that makes sense.
I'm curious. This is Ken Corum again for the people on the phone. I'm curious, when you I don't quite know what you mean by the difference between manual and automatic. Are we talking about that manual in the sense of the people on the premise got a call or got a notification and
yes.
decided on the spot to do it or not?
Yeah, it wasn't on the spot.
Automatic would be they'd get a signal and then it just happened?
Right. So automated, we would expect results within 10 minutes. And we would have automated controls, so it's more of a direct load control scenario. And manual, you know, we would call them maybe an hour ahead. In some cases, we tried the day before. We found an hour ahead was the best, 30 minutes to an hour ahead was the best time range to give them to go and flip the switch themselves.
So
and they prefer to have that control, obviously.
So they can respond or not.
Right.
I think there's a perception sometimes that manual means voluntary, and in this case, the customers were contractually on the hook to respond. They just had.
So they paid a penalty if they didn't. Or
no, they didn't. They didn't pay a penalty, but they didn't get. They didn't get the incentives that they would be expecting. And
okay.
And they, the general way these contracts work is they agree to do it when dispatched unless they can't. But the manual basically it's a function of response time. If they have to take some action to go shut down a production line or turn off a breaker, that response typically takes 30 to 60 minutes. If the utility, in this case, you know, PSE, needs 10-minute response, then you pretty much have to directly interface with the building management system to make it happen that quickly.
Okay. And what I heard you say was there was a there was a preference on the customer's part for manual, and there's a preference on the utility's part for, I mean, you had a quicker response. So.
Right.
Okay.
That's true.
And I guess that's what I would have I would have expected that. In the RFP, what were the terms? Were you shooting for automatic?
Originally we asked for a program that was similar to our pilot, but we would definitely want to change that and go for at least a percentage of automated.
I had a question about the, you say you're planning to do some critical peak pricing, and I know Puget some years ago did a time of use pricing approach. So how does this differ, if it does, from that former project?
Well, this is from the IRP perspective, and so we're just looking at the potential by strategy in the IRP. You know, there's a lot of variability there. I mean, a lot of variables that would affect the decision to go forward with something with a program like that. Certainly in the current market, it wouldn't make sense. But
is your question about what a critical peak price arrangement is?
I think it's fairly similar.
Well, let me take a cut.
Go ahead.
My general understanding of a critical peak price arrangement is, I'll just make up some numbers here, that for 100 hours a year, the customer is going to pay four or five times what he usually does. His price the rest of the time, the other 86.60 hours, will be reduced so that if he does nothing, if he just behaves like he always has, he won't lose any money. He will be paying a high rate for those 100 hours, but he pays lower rates the rest of the time they balance. What that creates is the possibility that during those 100 hours, he will respond. He'll save some money. And the trick, the kind of clever thing to my mind when I first heard of this was that the 100 hours aren't specified except the day before. The customer knows there are going to be 100 hours sometime during the year, so presumably he's prepared, and the utility knows a day ahead or has a pretty good idea of which days they're going to have a problem, and they notify their critical peak pricing participants the day before, and then they pay those higher prices for whatever they use, and it just shows up, you know, just shows up on the meter. There's no payment back to the customer. The customer gets his incentive through the savings. So that's different. A time of day rate is kind of set for a year in advance based on the expected costs of those different blocks of hours. The point of a critical peak price arrangement is, you know, there will be some hours that are, you know, where the costs to the utility of providing are quite a bit higher than they are on average, even for a peak hour. It's something like, yeah, but the exposure is limited to the customer, and, you know, yeah, it's kind of a halfway between real time and time of use.
Is Bruce Pearlson of Navigant, just clarification on the CPP programs, at least in California. There's also credits against the rate that customers would otherwise pay in non-event hours. So there is some compensation for participating in the program, not just with compensation for exposing yourself to the risk of paying higher prices during CPP events if you don't reduce your consumption. And some of these programs are instituted on a default basis. That is, you're enrolled on it unless you choose to opt out, and very often that's to a TOU rate. The other difference is that the critical peak pricing prices are set in advance, during the peak period, whereas TOU rates are set for specific time periods and specific seasons of the year for peak off-peak prices. So there's additional element of risk for a customer participating in a CPP program.
And there's a really nice detailed description in our IRP in the appendix section that's demand-side resources.
Hi, this is Lee Hall of EPA. Kim, great presentation, and we're very interested in your results and your successes. If you could, would you mind sharing, on a previous slide you showed that you had referenced or looked at other utility programs. Would you mind sharing maybe two or three of those that you would look at that others might model their programs after?
That was actually done by CADNUS, looking at the other programs. And that is also listed out in our IRP in that same appendix. There's a number of tables that show the potentials that we look at and what the assumptions are and where some of that data came from. And so there are some references to other studies that other utilities have done.
Just to be sure that I understand, my understanding was that you had an RFP for some DR, and what happened was there were supply side alternatives that were especially cheap because loads were down and gas prices were down and all of that, and so you went with those for good reasons. Your kind of expectation is those conditions won't last forever, and the DR will have a place, down the road a few years.
That's correct.
Okay, all right. Do we have some other questions? Well, we can talk with PG. Is there another one?
Yeah. Just one quick question. If you were to,
it's on.
Yeah. If you were to update that chart for 2013, do you have a sense of what it would look like?
Yeah, I think it's really just going to be pushed out a few years for 2013. The potential is not changed really as much compared this strategy to the next. The potential is about the same. It's just that it's delayed based on low fuel costs. I will say that we did learn that the residential type of programs would be a lot more expensive than we had in our 2011 IRP. And that was the main difference that we noticed going into the next IRP.
Kim, you had said that the criteria for DR, it has to be cost competitive with other resources. Are you looking at, what specifically are you looking at?
I knew someone was going to ask that question, and I don't know, because I'm not on the acquisition side, I don't know exactly what they're looking at. Okay. But, comparing it to another peaking unit, basically.
All right. Thank you. And it may be that after PG's presented, we'll have some more general questions as well.
Okay.
So Brian is going to talk about PGE's system.
Rich, I just want you to know I did bring a tie. This makes me feel better. I wasn't sure what the dress code would be, so I came prepared.
Sorry.
I'm originally from Oklahoma. I guess that's sort of back east from the perspective of over here. So that may be why I had a tie. We had a few people come in. Should we have them introduce themselves?
While we're at it, I know John came, and I think Paul Norman. People that didn't introduce themselves before, would they mind just telling us who they are? I know John wasn't here.
I'm John Horton. I'm with the
And I think Paul came in after.
Paul Norman. I'm retired from Seattle City Life.
I'm sorry, I didn't get.
David
Clement. Okay, we've talked. I didn't recognize you. I'm sorry. David Clement, Seattle City Life, for the people on the phone.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's something's weird.
Oh.
Who else needs a handout? Okay, EJ, we'll make these available in our extra class.
Robert Maris, electricitypolitics.com, Electricity Daily.
So this is showing two. This is showing small, so I'm not sure how to fix that. I wanted to go to.
Do we have an expert in the room that can make this image bigger? It's off a PDF.
Well, that's, I just did it. It wants to do, show me two pages at once.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
All right.
I printed it that way. I didn't realize it would turn into a PDF that way. I guess when I looked at it, it looked like full page, like full screen when I looked at it. So I apologize about that. First of all, let me just say it's good to see so many people here. I know it's so. Hopefully, this will be a friendly audience. And I also want to say I brought my colleague Isaiah Cox here with us. He's actually the program manager for demand response. So encourage questions at any point in time, and Isaiah will be happy to answer them. I'm Brian Keeney. I'm the manager of integrated resource planning for PGE. And we'll just skip to slide two on page one.
This is great.
Kind of like what Kim showed. Yeah, I apologize about that.
Oh, it may have been something we did here.
Okay. Yeah, that's it. It's something they did. Kind of like what Kim showed, this is PGE's energy load resource balance looking on an annual average basis. And we show this just to show that if we transact our current action plan out of the last IRP via the RFPs we have, we would be sort of in load resource balance in the next several years with some shortfalls toward the end of the decade. But if you flip to the next slide and you look at winter capacity look, and here we're looking at our single highest hour in the winter on a 1 and 2 basis, normal weather basis, to which we're adding 12% reserves, which is composed of operating reserves plus a contingency reserve. What becomes real evident is while energy shortfalls are modest, the capacity shortfalls are larger. This, of course, is probably not a surprise to anyone. It's pretty typical now throughout the Northwest. And then if we go to the next slide, this kind of breaks that out a little bit. These are the winter hours in 2014 broken into off-peak and on-peak. And traditionally, the role for demand response has been to deal with those occurrences of high loads, the stuff that's in the circle or the oval that's on the right-hand side, those events that really occur only maybe 20 or so hours a year, 20 or 30 hours a year, to where it's preferably you don't want to have steel in the ground dedicated to serving that load, and this is where demand response becomes very attractive, serving that right-hand tail of the distribution. On the next slide, PGE does have increased interest in demand response. That was not always the case, along with many utilities in the Northwest. Historically, we had a large hydro base. The hydro brought us about 2 megawatts for every 1 average megawatt of energy. And so we typically in the past were constrained by energy, not by capacity, and what we were worried about was things like poor hydro years. And capacity we had plenty of because of the hydro system and its ability to respond as needed. However, in the last decade, PGE has lost a material amount of its legacy mid-sea hydro resources, and we'll continue to do so in the next decade. Meanwhile, we, along with other IOUs in this region, are rapidly adding significant amounts of new variable resources, primarily wind. increasing amounts of solar. And these have, as you're aware, relatively low contributions to capacity, particularly in winter cold events. PGE in particular, currently we have 550 megawatts of wind on our system. To reach our 2015 RPS requirement here in the state, the renewable portfolio standard. The RPS would require us to get to between 800 and 900 megawatts of wind in that year. So in short, PGE now is constrained by capacity rather than energy. That's kind of a new problem in the last few years. And flexibility within that is increasingly important because of the variable energy. So how does PGE approach demand response? Any questions so far? Yes. Okay, I guess no questions, so we'll move on. No, I'm just kidding.
Do you have a specific percentage you're assigning for wind capacity?
Yes.
And do you know what that number is?
Okay.
Will you provide that number?
Yes. You were going to have to pull it out of me. We have basically relied on some of the Power Council studies where they have used 5%. I believe that you're still using 5%. I don't know for sure.
Masood, do you know? Do you know what we're using now? That sounds.
Yeah,
it's
I believe
in that
it's still
for sure.
5% is what we assume is the contribution. Anecdotally, the truth is, in a winter event, and I could have put a slide in here that showed that the last significant winter event we had that was a multi-day event, over the course of 10 days, the wind averaged about our annual capacity factor. But it was well above the capacity factor at the front end of the event, and at the back end of the event when the systems were going from low to high and vice versa, the weather systems. In the middle of the event, for several days, the wind was at zero, and that's the anecdotal reality that we deal with those kind of resources. David.
Brian, the amount of wind that you're projecting in the portfolio is pretty sizable, and I'm just curious how much of that variability to balance that wind are you looking at from demand response?
Well, we're looking at every tool in the toolbox, regardless of its size, David. And so, as you'll see on a future slide here, we're hoping to get about 45 megawatts of demand response. So it's not going to solve the problem or come close to solving it. But if it's available and it's cost-effective, we are all for getting it, along with any other capacity response that's available out there. For PGE, dispatchable standby generation in particular has been very attractive, and we have, I think, around 100 megawatts of that now, I think, of dispatchable standby generation, and that is so that, you know, we'll find anything we can get that will provide that. So PGE's approach to demand response. Oh, another question, sorry.
Yeah, just one quick one. You cited here, you said by 2015 you're going to have 800 to 900 megawatts of wind on the system. Could you just venture a guess as to the percentage that would represent of a low load day?
Yes, our average load is I need my calculator here. Our average load day is about 2,100. If you look at that other chart on here, you can sort of see where the average winter load is at, which is a number I completely can't read, but it's the dotted line there. But the point is it would represent probably about 3/4 of a low load. It's a real issue going forward. On off-peak loads or the shoulder loads and the seasonal shoulder loads in this spring and fall, which is when the wind tends to blow, it's going to comprise a very significant amount of the load. When the wind's blowing at 100%, I mean.
So you're interested in Bonneville's experience with oversupply, because it could happen.
Yes, although I think our bigger practical concern, oversupply is for us an economic issue because we can always feather the wind. The bigger practical concern that I have from an IRP perspective is whether we have sufficient flexible generation to ramp up or ramp up quickly enough. It's a two-tailed issue. The one tail is sort of an economic issue when the wind's coming up rapidly and backing down. The other one, though, is an issue of the wind's coming off rapidly and you need to rig up rapidly, and that's the reliability issue that most concerns us. Okay, so...
Am I on the right slide now? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
So PGE's approach is the first thing we do is, as Kim mentioned, we also do an update to our demand response potential. We hire a third-party expert on this. This last time it was the Brattle Group. We give them specific territory-specific data on our customers, their end-use patterns, the kind of loads we have from them. And from that study then helps inform what our ask should be in the demand response RFP, which we put out. And we did issue an RFP this fall requesting automated demand response products and pricing. I should have said automated on there. And this description here is sort of generic. It shouldn't be interpreted as probably being quite as linear as what has been laid out here. It's a little more organic than that, but basically what happens upon issuing that RFP, we look at the responses. We did have a number of responses this fall. We look at those proposals, their delivery capabilities, the costs, the stability and the capitalization of those third-party vendors, and perform an economic analysis of their programs. And we hold that economic analysis against, for automated demand response proposals specifically, we hold that against the cost of a simple cycle CT. And I've got LMS 100, but I think they're, aren't they LMS 1000s? Whatever they're called. But the kind of the cutting edge simple cycle CTs, we look at that as our alternative cost benchmark. We make adjustments for attributes that ADR brings us, like avoidance of line losses, avoidance of environmental emissions, and so forth. And so we give those value that the simple cycle CT wouldn't have. Going to the next slide, and I'll pause for questions here after this next slide. This will.
Sorry. Oh, I'm behind. Sorry.
And this will kind of complete our approach to it, and then I'll pause for questions again. We do look at other capacity response alternatives. They're also judged against the same avoided cost standard and against each other. So we look at things like dispatchable standby generation, as I mentioned. We look at pumped hydro storage, battery storage, and we look at a combined cycle CT and whether maybe that's a better approach than any of the others. We do make value considerations. We recognize that all of these products have different value propositions in terms of their firmness, their dispatchability, their response time, how many strikes you can have per season, advance notice, all those kinds of things. And then to the extent a DR program is found to be economic, it's incorporated into the IRP as an acquisition target. So we're not really evaluating demand response in real time in the IRP against the other things. We're kind of doing it outside of the IRP and bringing in the results of that. And then when we look at tariffs, everything to this point's been talking about programmatic demand response, things like automated demand responses that's delivered by a third party. But we also, of course, have tariffs, time of use, and similar tariffs. Because these aren't firm demand response, the impact of these kinds of demand shifting tariffs is embedded into our load forecast. It's not a separate explicit adjustment or resource action. So I'll pause at this point for any additional questions. It's kind of how we approach IRP. And anyone except Dave is allowed to ask a question.
Sorry, Brian, I had to ask anyway. Just curious on doing your forecast of shifts in load as a result of time of use pricing. What have you found, and is there any significant shift?
But, you know, we're just in the next slide, or a couple slides from here, we'll talk about the programs. We're just in pilot stage, and they haven't been evaluated. That's what we're trying to find out is when we aggregate, how much shifting can we really depend on to show up? I don't think, Isaiah, that we really know that yet in any.
Our load forecaster does consider time of use, and it is a program now, but it's pretty negligible. There's about 3,000 customers that have opted in, so not a major impact. And he does run it in the model with everything else.
Yeah. It is small at this point. That was my point as well.
I guess in terms of forecasting the shift in load and so forth, I would look at the potential based upon its economic value given the change in the prices and basically what the capabilities would be, not necessarily what you've experienced in terms of soliciting from customers.
Okay. Thanks.
You mentioned earlier in the slide that I believe you said it wasn't, that DR wasn't directly incorporated into the IRP. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, what I meant was it's more of an input. It's the same with energy efficiency. We kind of develop it. We give them avoided cost parameters, and they come back to us with how much EE we can put in up to a cost effectiveness limit. And this is kind of similar because it's so specific, and we don't know until we've gone out and done an RFP. We kind of have to do this as a separate input into the IRP, where we've gone out and said, in this RFP, by the way, we said we are looking for a minimum product of 25 megawatts of demand response, but as a minimum, and of course greater would be great. But we're doing that as an input to the IRP.
Thanks.
I have another question too.
Hi, it's Ken Nichols with EQL Energy. One question, I think most people in this room know about Idaho sort of turning their DR off, and I'm wondering if you consider the flexibility that comes with DR versus SCT when looking at the costs over a 10, 20-year time frame?
We do. That was my reference to the value considerations. And, everything's got its advantages. Fossil combustion has optionality that is attractive, but then there are obviously aspects that aren't attractive. If you're asking do we have a specific set of considerations, I don't know that we go through a checklist, if that's what you're asking. But yeah, we try to consider what's the quality of the product we get. You know, for instance, with the fossil fuel alternative, it's an 8760 product, whereas this traditional demand response is pretty targeted to a subset of hours within the winter and summer seasons, so it's got less value that way, less flexibility. Does that answer the question?
I guess my point is it has more flexibility, meaning if you put steel in the ground with a CT, it costs $1,200 a kW, whatever that number is. And with DR, you could run it for 4 years, at some variable cost,
right,
and then turn it off. So I guess if you're looking at a 10, 20-year time frame, that flexibility, I would think, adds value.
Oh, right. Sure.
When we look at them now, referring to what was going on, that's gone on in California, developing cost-effectiveness evaluation protocols, is treat DR as an option. Yeah, it avoids energy that you can dispatch on a flexible basis, and you can estimate that using either option evaluation models or stochastic production cost modeling, and to estimate the cost of capacity if you don't have market value as capacity by deducting from the fixed cost of the CT, the energy rents you would get by being dispatched on an economic basis, as well as whatever operating income, or excuse me, gross margin it could earn by providing ancillary services, again, taking account of the assumption that the CT would only be dispatched if it was economic to do so. So, again, you're taking into account the flexibility. As far as taking account of the limits on the usage and availability, you can do that by using integer linear programming model to optimize the use of the CT, assuming perfect foresight.
Ken.
It seems like 25 megawatts is a big number for this sort of nascent industry, DR. Is there a thought to doing more pilot demonstrations, smaller scale, to build up to a bigger market?
The last one did start as a pilot. I don't know if this one, does it start as a pilot? Yes, the answer is yes. So we should say we're kind of limited in how much we can say on this because we're actually still in negotiations on this RFP, and so we can tell you what we've asked for in the RFP. We can't say a lot right now about where we're at in that process. The 25 megawatts, by the way, is exclusively from commercial and industrial customers. It's automated demand response with those customers.
Did you get a good response? I mean, maybe I'm off base on where the market is for this.
Would you?
We got your RFP.
Yeah.
A lot of respondents.
We got a lot of respondents. I can't say whether they were good responses. I can just say we have it a lot. Yes. Maybe I say I can.
Hi. This is Howard Schwartz from the Washington Council staff and the State Energy Office. One of the themes in your presentation, I think, is the difference between traditional DR, which responds to seasonal peaks, and trying to have DR as a resource, as part of your resource portfolio. What's the difference in approach, in your planning approach to those two things, and how much DR does PGE have for traditional winter peaking?
Let me answer the last question first. Right now we have a curtailment tariff with large industrial customers. That's our Schedule 77. We currently have 17 megawatts on that. To your first question now, right now PGE is working solely on traditional demand response for capacity, reliability kinds of events in the winter and summer, limited winter and summer conditions. Down the road, us along, I'm sure, with everyone else, would like to look at the so-called demand response 2.0. which would be a product that might be available more like 8760. But right now, that's not where we're focused because we kind of need to make the first work first. Isaiah, you wanted to add something?
And that's from Brian's IRP perspective, but as a pilot and things that we're looking at from my area, we are actively engaged with the flexible, and we have a pilot coming up where we're working with some smart water heaters, not the style that the BPA has been using, but the newer style with the plug. I think they've done that too, though, as well. But we are looking at, but Brian doesn't look at that because he's looking at more of the how can we provide for the whole system, and when those things become realistic that we'll bring it to Brian and say, okay, this is ready to go. So, so I'm just clarifying that we're not ignoring flexible.
Right.
It's just Brian hasn't considered an IRP.
Right.
Yet.
And I was kind of forgetting about the water heaters, actually. So good point. Thank you, Isaiah.
I have a question about the pilot, what it looks like, you know, what it includes, like the water heaters, for instance, what type of customers, how many, what your, is it, has that been decided yet, or?
Well, we have several pilots. Might be best at this point if I cover a couple more slides, and maybe that will address that. Okay. And if not, then we can re-ask the question. So going on to... just as a reminder of what our action plan is, the next slide. This gives context for where demand response fits into our overall ask for new resources, supply and demand side. In the last IRP, we requested 60, our target was to acquire 60 megawatts of demand response by 2016. We've since revised that to about 45 megawatts, and then you can see the context for other resources that are in that plan. So that was to kind of give you an idea where it fits in. Going to the next slide, the next couple slides talk about what is PGE actually doing, what's our current status. This is... it says November 2011. I think it means to say November 2012. Just now noticed that for the first time. We currently have Schedule 77 curtailment tariff, as I mentioned, 17 megawatts are participating. Our ultimate target is to achieve 20 megawatts. We have the water heater direct load control pilot that Isaiah mentioned. It's a small pilot. We're just trying to learn from that at the moment. But as he says, this will give us a lot of learning because it'd be something that's available 8760 to us. We have a critical peak pricing pilot. Here we had 1,000 residential customers. One of the main learnings we got from that was a fairly high amount of attrition. We've lost about 370 customers of the original 1,000. However, of that, about a third of it were just move-outs, people that were in multifamily apartments primarily that moved, and the program doesn't just automatically go with them. They have to re-opt in. As far as results of that, we don't know. We won't know until this spring. And we have an informational tool that you probably heard ads for on the radio, the Energy Tracker. So that brings us to automated demand response, which is the other big item. Originally, we had a pilot project that was expected to start with 5 megawatts and, if successful, increase up to 50 megawatts. We had a contractor for that. The contractor was unable to meet the terms of the agreement, and therefore the contract was terminated. And that's what prompted the new RFP that we mentioned earlier that we issued this last fall. And again, we did a demand response potential update to help inform that RFP and help the vendors by letting them know what the market potential looks like. So now back to your question as to which pilot, which pilot you were referring to, I'm not sure. Any of them? Yes. That's right. That's a good point. Conrad Eustace is on the program for this afternoon. He's going to talk about our experience so far with water heaters, and I think in particular with trying to get standardization of of the equipment and the communication protocols and so forth, which we see as a key thing, some market transformation that needs to take place. So my last slide, I think, implementation considerations, PGE, like Puget, is winter peaking. Our observation is that most material demand response programs have leveraged off summer end uses, primarily air conditioning and irrigation. PGE cost spreads. PGE's rates are relatively low compared to, like, California, for instance, and our cost spreads between peak and super peak and off peak are typically modest. This makes it hard when we do some of the tariff programs and a customer is real diligent and then they find out that they've saved 25 cents, you know, and it makes it hard. Market prices are well below fully allocated costs for new resources right now. This makes it tempting to just rely on the market. And we see market transformation as a key thing for the mass markets anyway, for things like water heaters, to have standardization of communications and control equipment to make the mass market demand response more economically attractive. Other questions, or should we just have both of us?
I have a question, and maybe this is rich for both, and that is whether the values of flexibility to integrate renewables have found their way into pricing programs, or is that really the demand response 2.0 and not the peak-oriented demand response? I can see why that is down the road, but what are you thinking about how the flexibility aspects and values are going to hit the customers who deliver them?
Well, when you're looking at loads net of variable energy, what we really need is true demand response, pretty much real-time demand response. And tariff programs will help because they'll reshape the load and maybe make that less demanding, but it's going to do nothing for the variable energy side. So we really are focused on ways to provide sufficient up and down regulation and so forth off the off our supply and demand resources. Does that address the question?
No. I mean, it suggests that you have more to go, but...
Yeah.
Does somebody on the phone want to weigh in on that? I heard somebody say no, so...
Well, just to check whether I heard you right, if there's any potential for load to do some actual load following or load for doing load following, I think everybody kind of has an idea what I to provide balancing services, either regulation or somewhat slower. It's probably not going to be in response to a conventional. Even a real-time price, because real-time prices probably stop at about an hour, and these are responses that are shorter than that. So I think that was part of your point is
right.
Conventional rates aren't going to do anything about that.
Right. That's why things like automated demand response and dispatchable standby generation look good to us, because we can actually respond with those.
Where you have control.
Yeah, there's control.
And you pay...
They're dispatchable.
You pay for the option of using them that way
right.
instead of by the,
we
by
need,
the kilowatt.
We need dispatchability, in short.
This is Ken Nichols. I'll follow on with what Rich on the renewable integration is. Yesterday, the council had a symposium on energy storage. Just curious if energy storage is getting into the conversation regarding resource planning at Puget or PGE.
I would say we have conversations about that, but not related to the IRP right now.
PGE is developing a I think it's a 4-megawatt battery storage in Salem. I think it's basically done. 5 megawatts, thank you. Well, something like that, 5 megawatts, and that's specifically to learn about how that can work, particularly on a distributed reliability type basis. Yeah, so we're looking at that. We've looked at pumped hydro storage, and I mentioned that in an earlier slide. We look at any capacity response alternative, again, dispatchable standby generation, batteries, pumped hydro storage are all on the table. And they were in this last RFP, and we had proposals come in for battery storage. I don't know if we did for pumped hydro or not. I didn't work on the RFP, but it was, you know, it's all on the table for us, but we kind of have to know what the market's going to bring, and that's what we're unsure about.
Have we drained the audience?
I hope so.
We actually had
any
some
questions from the phone.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
We had some pump primer questions, but we didn't need them. And we're just, I think we'll call it good because we need to move on to the next topics. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Kim. And just so. People want to stand up and stretch for just a couple of minutes, and we're going to be getting on quickly.